So a few brief words on what I call the derivative condition or derivative logics. I've spoken a few things about this in the switches section, so I'm not going to be too kind of detailed on that, because I want to go through a few examples of infrastructure, states, deregulation, which is actually nothing else but self-regulation of these markets, and then talk a bit about tokenization. The technosphere's unbound release is not simply an accelerated expansion, but a swing, a wave, a contingent move from the beginning. As a manifestation of volatility that performatively collects demands and often co-opts the relations of what it enunciates, it follows a derivative logic. The derivative, I would argue, is sort of the first metadata in a technological sense. It is the metadata of uncertainty, the firstborn risk that at instance proliferates into all expectations of what can possibly be conceived. Since 1987, that is since the big crash that happened in October of that year, the derivative is the metadata, as metadata has actually really taken over. Instead of being replaced by another logic, it was re-engineered and it was turned around, so the way it is used was kind of like switched. It was not anymore that the underlying asset, the prostitute, or whatever you want to call it, was the actual point of reference from where you would look at volatility, which would be the first derivative, and then to the variance of the volatility, which would be the second derivative, but it was turned around. You call that dynamic hedging or implied volatility, and that is actually what the derivatives market really started to sweep across all markets and became the paradigmatic form of trading. Now what happens is that the derivatives actually are priced and are traded by themselves and not just are an indicator. So the metadata is the actual traded object that then talks about the underlying. So from that moment on, the underlying asset becomes secondary to volatility, to the random shift, jump, swings, or the lack thereof. What is the token in this configuration? And I think, interestingly, the token of this regime is nothing else than money proper, money itself, that stands in for anything fungible, anything that can be traded, anything that can be commodified, can be exchanged. And if you extend that, and if, for example, think of Klossowski's living money, you see how far that moves, how much it also includes the body, and I think you referenced that in your vignette very beautifully. So, but the derivative is not a principle per se. It is a move. It is the move of moves, one could say, the logic of escalation that creates jumps without swinging, that speaks within the swing. It consolidates matter, and in its own form, data, without being matter, so data. It is metadata of an underlying, at the same time, the virtual epiphany of the very potentials. While what matter is to accelerate in the technosphere, it's all about acceleration in the beginning, and with every leap, the new speed becomes the new normal. The derivative, as a technology, one could call it, because it's more and more becoming an automated algorithmic force of production of knowledge, a kind of tech knowledge, permeates all manifestations, even those that haven't yet manifested, and encapsulates the linearity of speed into multifarious movements of non-directional, non-linear, fleeting entanglements. In this derivative condition, where solids are prone to drift, power shifts from representational to performative speech. That is why we cannot read it, why it doesn't communicate in images, but also its language is something that really doesn't speak to anyone. It is not just a hidden language, not something that is arcane. I think it's a language that is built to deliver process, to deliver performance, so to say. So the put the long, the short, the call, all that is really about the performative moment, the change, the switch, the recalibration within these processes. It evokes an old drain of the relative, of the precarious and the contingent. The incessantly recalibrated cascades of derivatives generated on derivatives from a volatile grid of anticipation in which bounding and unbounding happen at liquid moments. As moments of the nearest future, these liquidities annihilate the present, annihilate the bond between past, present, and future. Confronted with the creation of extremes volatility as a scheme to leverage power and profit, and leverage, I think, is a very crucial, one could even say tool, in this respect, as a technique or even more, in the switches section, I referred to a reading of leverage that I think we should not forget when we speak about debt, which we very often do, that there is another debt. There is a debt that opens to the future, that makes the future a productive form that you can recalibrate, that you can produce, in which you can hatch your bets during that time, in which you can externalize specific risks. And all that is, there is a word for that, and this is leverage. So if you look at this in the sense of a social form, we could actually really delineate a class system of our contemporary age, where you have the different tiers of leverage classes, debt classes, and those which are not even in debt. Right? So leverage is the other side, the opening, the optionality side of debt, which I think we need to take into account. Within this situation with extreme volatility, when this, as we see today in many, many instances, where escalation becomes a form of production, a form of being first, so to say, in media and in politics, with that, this creation of volatility, if that becomes extreme, what happens is that the old paradigm that we're all used to, kind of like how things are measured and evaluated, that is the probability paradigm, snaps. Normal distribution is speechless in the mob phase of fat tail events. Unbounding what matters, and unbounding matter at the same time, the derivative paradigm introduces a non-order of contingency, an instance at which we can learn how to leverage the optionality ingrained in the derivative instead of attempting to hedge what cannot be secured anyways, and understand volatility as a techne, as a performative risk practice by which we might unleash potentialities of present futures. I think that is the way that we should look at this and take it forward by somehow affirming it to be able to kind of develop new forms of practices. Because in a sense, if you use the word hatching, what is included in this is the word insurance, of course. But it's a form of reinsurance that is versatile, that is open, that can be adapted in different instances. So the question that interests me, where is the leverage that allows us to not only survive, but to serve these waves of volatility, to create the performative flow of a future saturated in presence? Because what gets lost if the future is kind of annihilated through old obligations of debt is actually the present where it is born. And in the instance of our theme today, what is the role of the token in this infrastructure, in this stateless state, the shifting maze of interconnections and disconnections that the derivative spawns, recalibrates, and dissolves incessantly? Okay. I think I need a drink. I'm totally dry, sorry. Structure. What you see here is a trading floor, and I think everyone knows what a trading floor is. This is a newer form, and if you look at finance, you could kind of define it into different forms of profit centers that change over time. And the old original one, of course, are the traders, but these kind of classic traders that would stay in the trading pit that Ilya Yash was talking about on Wednesday and Thursday. that he believes in the people that kind of exchange, that are matter, that are body, that together perform what the market is, so to say. This is the next step, that this is the first change of the profit center from traders to quants, to quantitative analysts. The people that come from Ivy League schools, from MIT, from the best mathematical and physics institutions, and work for huge investment banks, or if they're really smart, start their own hedge funds. This is the largest ever trading floor, which is UBS, Swiss Bank, but it's in Stamford, Connecticut, very near to New York. It's a center of hedge fund and investment bank trading. But if you look at this, it existed for roughly 6 years, I would believe. Now it's an empty hall. There's nothing. Old cars are parked in it. So this kind of form of infrastructure was massive, was extremely profitable, of course, but today it's history. With it, there is this term, the Bloomberg Terminal, that maybe also some of you might have heard, which is a split screen that opens into the space, as in finance they would call it, which is into the market, into the trading of derivatives or sorts or assets of all sorts and commodities of all sorts. It always depends where what kind of sector it more or less is. You can see there's quite a few of them. And the way that it kind of surrounds you, the way that it produces you as a trader, because in this instance, in this kind of world, the trader and the quant work together, right? Is something that I think Karin Knoll-Cettina has shown quite nicely when she was interviewing traders, Swiss traders, in early 2000s. I'm not quite sure which year it was exactly, where these people speak about the being. So they don't say the market or whatever kind of market it is. So they speak about the being which in which they are and which they are. So it becomes this hyper-identification. So this the Bloomberg Terminal is more or less a door through which you go, and then you're in this kind of game space, if you like. No? It's a little bit like in virtual games, where real players are also kind of like within that and identify with the surroundings, with the difference that the decisions done here don't stay in the game, but of course have enormous consequences in all kind of different worlds than just the financial one. That's another one. That's in a hedge fund. What I found interesting about this hedge fund is it's guys that are about 30 years old, listen to hip-hop, are super cool, live in New York. What do? They share a flat. And it totally reminded me of the 80s, 90s New York art scene, where people would share flats to work, live, and party together. This is not dead, obviously. This has just kind of changed gentrification position, if you like, and it's now the new generation of young hedge fund guys that live that life and love it, of course. This is a change now to the next profit center. That profit center is the coders. So they kind of like replace the quants. This is when automation develops on a level where it completely overtakes the production of profits, where the the amount of what you need to invest to what you get out is the most interesting. This is when hedge funds start to develop automated trading systems, when things happen like high-frequency trading, which I'm sure you've heard about, and I think we cannot talk too much about it. It would be too long to do that. But just to give you a few images on how this change happens. This is, I don't know if the video works, this is how trade in high-frequency trading works, meaning how it is faster than a so-called normal trade, how it can do that. Okay. Shut up. Should I say fuck? It would be a situation for that, no? algorithmic trading structure. That's maybe one point I would like to stress before we go to the tokenization part, is that these are kind of like the most important trading venues worldwide. But actually, it's the US that, until now, is like the major player. It has 13 official venues, trading venues, but about 65 dark pools. So you can see how intense the competition is. And that is something that has had enormous effects more recently, because you can imagine that, you know, in the developer world, so to say, which is a high-frequency trader world, this is hyper-competitive, and it's about latency. That means how fast you can be in relation to the material world, so to say. If you imagine that if people realize that this is a profit opportunity, how many will go into that world? A lot. So competition becomes more and more and more, which means that even for the old and the big players and the smart players, it becomes more and more difficult to really produce profit in that situation. So what do you do? And that is where the next profit center kind of starts to develop. You have to find other ways of making profits if you can't do it with your normal kind of strategy. And if you know that in the US, you have so many different exchanges, and you know that they are corporations themselves, which means that they need to produce profit, you realize that there is competition also between market centers. So that means that they have to try to bring in volume. That means a lot of people that trade there. So what happens is that their incentive schemes start to happen. And the second thing is that more and more people from hedge funds or big banks start to buy up shares from market centers. So what you have is sort of developing information asymmetries between those that know how the exchange works and those who don't. And that within finance, and I'm not talking about mom-and-pop investors, so to say. So what is happening now, and there's a whistleblower who I'm working together with personally, who won a case in that field, so this is evidenced, is what you call regulation arbitrage. You start using regulation or working against regulation because you know how it works, how you implement it, or how it has to be implemented. And by that, you realize where there are kind of situations where the information crosses or there are holes of information that you can exploit. When you also know that this is a very complex field, where it's very, very hard that someone catches you, especially because you have to prove every case very, very clearly, which means you have to have a lot of intense expertise to be able to go into that and really prove it, you can see that this is actually an interesting profit situation, which led to that next situation. That's what I mean with the change in the profit center, is that more and more regulators are buying hedge funds or buying themselves into hedge funds, and hedge funds buying market centers, because they know how it works. So the regulators now game the regulations. And this is a sort of game that is played because the normal possibility of making profits in that field because of latency or speed doesn't work anymore. I think it's highly interesting because it means that somehow this form of capitalism completely hit the wall, because it's proof that there is no equilibrium or anything like that. But for kind of producing profits for owners, etc., you have to use all kinds of methods, whatever the methods are. Is it so dry, or is it only me? So this was like where infrastructure goes today and how this develops. Something else. Now this is, of course, this other side of finance that's been developing from a purely technological position. And you can see this is a screenshot from just a few days ago, like how also capitalized or how strongly incentivized trading in blockchains has become. It's not like in the beginning, of course, that some scientists and some geeks were in that field. Now it's like the new idea, the new possibility for investing. And this is, and you find hundreds of movies where people talk about like how they made millions, et cetera, et cetera. So it's become sort of a penny stock, which means a speculative object. I'm just showing this. I want to say something else, actually. But I'm just showing this kind of like these differences between how a normal trade works and how blockchain work. But what I think what changes here with the tokenization is when we talked about the token before as actually being money in derivative markets, what happens here is what connects the human and the non-human in the algorithmic technosphere within that world is the hash. And as it is not reversible and has to be created each time, it is sort of a quant legal entity. It's a technopolitical individual. The token could be interpreted as a form of labor, a decentralized automated labor, high tech in its capability to boil down various occupations and their specific temporalities and values into a flash produced digital simulacrum or counter image of what is even beyond and outside labor, the potencia, to use a Spinoza term, of becoming. The token identifies the being in a verifiable moment, which it, however, doesn't normalize. That is, it doesn't give it an immutable, lasting identity. Rather, the token constitutes versatile and variable identification within a performative realm in which representation is not only completely detached from what and who it represents, but in excess opens a parallel plane of subjectivity to which the physical subject has no access. What protects identity at the same time annihilates it within the systemic recalibrations, the token is the individual, which for a while now has been embodied in the corporation and not in the subject as such. Just going on. This is like hashing works. This change corresponds to the sea change that occurred with the derivatives after 1987, re-engineered the operations, altered their poles from the underlying asset at center to the derivative at center. This is called dynamic hedging and implied volatility, as I said before. It means that the metadata of volatility and variance became the actual data traded. The derivative only then became a market proper, and from then on, finance turned to price of the derivative to calculate the price of the asset and not the other way around. But in this takeover, the polarity switched as well, from hedging risk to producing risk, from fearing volatility to creating volatility as competitive advantage, in which noise becomes the master of information. And what comes to fruition is the performative quality of the derivative as a new speech of power. The token, we can say, is a derivative, the metadata of the underlying identity, and represents it in a performative way within the ecosphere. But as such, it takes over the functions of the asset, and we are assets of our own making and of those investing in and speculating on us, and produces a new subject and a new subjectification that is outside the body, even though digitally incorporating in the body. The biotoken is the derivative of the former subject that in turn assumes subject status, amongst other reasons because we're dealing here with contracts and contractual questions. The derivative is not only a technology of the future, it is in any instance a contract in a diversity of meanings, and especially one of trust as future expectation. However, I'm critical of the general explanation for the thrust and direction these schemes are based on, which is the promise. Rather, I would argue, promise is a linguistic persuasion device. Both the contractual and conceptual cores come through much more clearly in the lesser known other term for the derivative, the contingent claim, that has no state and no states. Thank you.